Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Shane Murphy, and today I'm interviewing Assistant Professor Diana Nadeo from Western Connecticut State University. She runs the internship program in the psychology department there, and she also works at Associated Neurologists in Danbury, Connecticut.
Thank you so much for taking the time, because this is an interview about what we do as psychologists and in the mental health field, let's just start off with that. What do you do? I mean, both at Western, but also I think the students are interested in elsewhere.
Yes, definitely. This might make me sound a little nutty. I have a lot of different roles. So I'm at WestCon, I teach in the psychology department, and then also in the graduate program in mental health counseling. My primary job is at a medical group called Associated Neurologists, where I work in the behavioral medicine department providing individual therapy and testing to, my age limit. I work with age 4 to about 50 is my ending point, just based on where my training has been. So that's my primary clinical role. More recently, I'm doing some consulting work with the Jed Foundation, which is a nonprofit group that is trying to prevent suicides on college campuses. So they have a new program where they're going out to colleges to figure out how the whole college can be responsible for preventing suicide and it not just falling on the colleges or counseling center where it tends to fall. So I'm analyzing the reports and the surveys and writing feedback reports for each of the schools that they visit. So I kind of have my hand in a few different things, which is my preference to be able to do the
You like the variety.
Tasks. Absolutely.
Now, it was interesting, last week we interviewed Cheryl Smith, who basically has a private practice up in Cheshire, Connecticut. So tell us a little bit about what it's like to work at Associated Neurologists, because that's a different sort of applied mode where you're working in a group practice.
Absolutely. There's pros and cons to working in a structured setting like that. One con is that there's a certain, and I think this is pretty applicable to most medical practices, you have to see a certain number of patients each day, or it's expected that you do, versus a private practice where you maybe have more control over your schedule, which is certainly a luxury. The nice aspect of working in a medical group is we work very closely with the MDs on the third, or I point up because they're on the third floor, in referrals. So I work with a variety of populations, but I've been somewhat targeted as the child, adolescent, college student person. So I work really closely with the pediatric neurologist. So it's very common for medical issues and psychological issues to overlap. So it's really nice to be able to not only get the direct referrals, but be able to coordinate care. So him and I will meet weekly to talk about cases. There's the resources. If I have questions about a certain medical issue I'm not familiar with, kind of have that resource right at hand, and vice versa for him too. I think that working there also provides the diversity of clients so that I'm able to see work. You know, this morning I had a few appointments with some parents. This afternoon I'll see a variety of teenagers, younger children, a few adults in the mix. So I think that's something that appeals to me versus being just specialized to one type of population.
Now, your referrals, do they come from the practice because the clients are coming in to see the neurologists and then they refer to you, or do they sometimes come directly to you?
Sometimes they come directly. Sometimes they're self-referred. When working in a medical practice, I'm on different insurance panels, so I'm sure we all know when we go look for a doctor of any nature, you go to your list and try and figure out maybe, you want to make some type of informed decision, but sometimes people are just therapy shopping, and so they'll come in self-referred. But for me, given the population I work with, and because there's only one pediatric neurologist in really in this area, I get a lot from referrals internally.
Now, is there somewhat of a team approach? Is there like mm-hmm. people who do assessments and then you get some data to work on and so on?
So that's the, well, I also, so I do therapy. That's like 60% of my time is direct therapy, and then 40% is doing different types of evaluations. So parents, and that's more the outside referrals. The school will say to parents, we really think your child needs to be further tested for ADHD, for like anxiety or behavioral issues. So they'll come in, and that's psychological testing. Then there's also psychoeducational testing, and that's if it's suspected that a child has a learning disability, attentional issue, or some they're really floundering at school, and they really can't figure out why. And that type of testing is much more involved and specific than tends to be more involved in specific because you're writing accommodations for the child to present to the parents to present to their school. So I kind of do all of that for that population. We're a very small staff. There's only three psychologists and then three psychologists and four neuropsychologists within our department.
Okay. And so the neuropsychologists do more of the cognitive impairment?
Yeah, the neuropsychologists work almost exclusively with individuals who are suspected to have Alzheimer's. Someone has an accident and is, you know, to assess progress or declines due to a traumatic brain injury, but they very much only work with adults.
Interesting. Yeah. We've covered traumatic brain injury in class, so that was something we've already mm-hmm. gone into in a little bit of detail. Did you want to ask a question, Evans?
I want to interject while you were talking about Alzheimer's, because I wanted to ask now before it became kind of irrelevant. Do you ever have any early onset Alzheimer's cases come in there?
Can't
Not for
speak.
You, but for the other guy. Do you ever see any?
I'm sure they do. It's an area I am completely unqualified to assess for.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Now, what would be a couple of the common assessment instruments you would use?
The Wechsler system, so the WISC or the WACE is always standard. For psychological testing, of course, a structured clinical interview, the personality assessment inventory. We use the CPT, which is a direct measure of attention. For psychoeducational, we'd use the Woodcock-Johnson test of academic achievement and other measures of executive functioning.
Very good.
Attention.
I see all these names that you encounter. They are practically used. Yes. Let's go back a little bit. What mm-hmm. what first got you interested in mental health issues? When was that?
I know. So I always my best friend always reminds me when we were in eighth grade. We had to go to work with, like, find someone we could go to work with, and I had chosen the guidance counselor in the middle school. So, I can't really recall what prompted that, but I think I clearly had some connection to the helping professions. I went to University of Massachusetts in Amherst and entered in as a psychology student. My parents were thrilled. And then I got drawn into it's very, there's a lot of emphasis on that campus on the arts and culture, things like film and television. And that seemed to be where my peer group gravitated towards. So I hopped out of psychology and went into communications, which obviously is a very respectable field. However, I think that there was aspirations I would continue with the psychology. So I ended up actually graduating with a major in communication and a minor in psychology. Had my first job out of college was at a public relations firm in New York City, and I hated it. It was so inconsistent with who I was, the schmoozing and the talking oneself. All of it. The sales aspect was not for me. I feel like my husband works in advertising, and that's very much, he can do all of that and does it really well. I recognized that it was not for me, and at that point, I enrolled in a master's program in counseling, which then took me on to my doctoral program.
So where was the master's in counseling, and what was their specialty?
So I did my master's in counseling at Fordham. There was no specialty. It was a very generalist counseling program. At that time, you could not get licensed at the master's level as a counselor. So this was about 15 years ago in New York State. So there wasn't a lot of guidance around what to do with the degree once you were done, nor was there a license. So jobs in the field were really favoring LCSWs and psychologists because they had the license underpinning their degree.
Was it a worry to you to get into a master's in psychology with a communications major? Was that something you're like, oh, are they going to take me?
I was concerned how that would jeopardize my chances of getting in or being asked about it in interviews. But I think the fact that I had that psychology minor helped, and I did take a few classes non-matriculated, so kind of to establish myself a little bit more before applying.
Okay.
So, but yeah, that was some anxiety about that.
And then from there?
And then from there, I worked for a few years in student development at Fordham University. So I was the director of student development for the graduate schools. I wanted to find a way. I really always had my training at the counselor in the counseling program was at a college health clinic. So I had a real interest in working with college students with mental health issues. At that time, as I said, it was very hard to find positions because I didn't have a license, clinical positions. So this was my way of trying to find some intermediary. Getting experience with the population without it being clinical. And during that time, I realized that for me, based on what I wanted to do, I needed to go back to get my doctoral degree. And it was what I wanted to do. I felt there was a lot of value in getting that extra training and experience.
So tell us about that choice. How did you decide where you went to go and mm-hmm. a little bit about maybe other programs you even applied to?
It was a tough... The application process to the doctoral program was a very tough experience for me. I took two rounds before I was accepted somewhere. This initial decision came from me feeling like the administrative aspect of college student life wasn't really what I wanted to do. It wasn't the clinical work that I had training with prior. But it did come in beneficial later on, having that experience. So I applied to just New York City schools my first year, Columbia, NYU, Fordham, which are pretty competitive. Got interviews at a few, but didn't make that final cut. And so the next year I expanded my search to Philadelphia and New York. And the program at Chestnut Hill College, which is in Philadelphia, was where I eventually ended up. I had to commute. I lived in Brooklyn at the time, so I commuted to my doctoral program because my husband works in advertising, and at that time, there really wasn't... If I was going to be in graduate school and not able to work, we needed someone to be able to work, and he couldn't do what he did anywhere else.
Philadelphia.
Right. But the program was offered, funding is a huge, I think if you're thinking about graduate program training, funding is a huge aspect of it. I said this in my last class. You can make a good living being a psychologist, absolutely, but correct me if I'm wrong, unless you can get on Oprah, you're not going to be a millionaire. So being aware of how much debt you might be accruing, I think is important to consider in terms of the financial stress that can cause later on. So the program funding was really beneficial, but more so the orientation. The program was, the training was blended psychodynamic theory and family systems theory, which were two that always appealed to me and that are pretty hard to come by these days, where CBT tends to be the predominant orientation of most programs.
So we had a really interesting discussion the week before last about PhD versus PsyD mm-hmm. and so on. So did that play a role, and what did you think of the Chestnut Hill program?
So can I be candid?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, okay. So I, the I learned a lot about the myths around, so my program was SID. I really did not want this ID. This ID is somewhat, historically has been seen as less than the PhD because the programs to get in are less competitive. So if a PhD program might take 5 students, a SID program might take 12 to 15. However, more recently, there are these professional schools, so these for-profit schools that are popping up. For example, not because I know anything about them, I'm just giving it as an example, Chicago School of Professional Psychology, Alliance School in California, where it's not selective, so they probably take 30 to 40 students per cohort, and there's no funding, and there is a high, it can accrue a lot of debt, but it's a way for people who might not be able to get into other programs can get in, and it really oversaturates the field. If you think about it, having a class with 5 to 10 students is going to be a much different training experience than having a class with 30 or 40 students. So my goal was just to try and choose a program that I had kind of, I accepted that the PsyD might be the way to go because I wanted to get started, but I really wanted to find a program that was based in a university so that there's like research and other training experiences and that had a moderate selectiveness so that I never had a class larger than 12 students and my initial cohort I think was 15.
And because we, when we got into that debate, part of it was like science versus practice.
Oh.
So how did you feel about, the science component of your doctoral training?
I wish that I had more research experience. I don't know that there were as many opportunities to engage in research, but I found that the dissertation and the chair that I worked with and the projects I worked on with her were enough, and I extended that by finding my own types of projects to work on, like locally. So it was a concern, but it wasn't gonna hold me. I didn't feel like it was a deal breaker. I felt like the statistics courses were robust enough where I could read a research article, speak knowledgeably about it, and I think having a dissertation was a huge component. Some don't require that.
Right, or they require a different sort of project. Yeah, and I think it's important to clarify is that a PsyD program is not like you don't get any science or research
and
training.
I think it's so important never to go into an interview and say, I want to do a PsyD because I don't like research. No, because I know you might feel that way, but push that down because the basis of being a psychologist is using the research to inform your practice. So even if you just want to be a clinician, ethically you're really supposed to have an understanding of what research of what works. It's like, what type of therapy do I use to treat OCD? And if you are putting it out there, you don't care about research, it kind of makes the whole picture crumble.
Very good. So from all your training, undergraduate, master's degree, PsyD, what maybe couple of themes or things or experiences have really helped you in your subsequent career?
I think my different internships and trainings were really helpful. I chose to take a generalist approach. My first year worked with kids, my second year worked with adolescents, my third year I worked in a city emergency room, which all have a very different feel in terms of what you do on a day-to-day basis. So for me, that was, looking back, I'm very happy that I did that because currently, I think part of the appeal of hiring me for my current position is they had no one that could work with kids or teenagers. So while that's not the only thing I do, it certainly helped open the door because I could do it. So I always advocate for more, at least initially, generalist training, and then as you become to understand yourself and what you like and what you don't like, getting more specific training later on. But in line with that, my supervisors were instrumental in me figuring out what I want to do, and not only like professionally, but also being a source of support and learning kind of about this field requires you to use yourself quite a bit. And I think you have to have a strong awareness of who you are, what you like, what you don't like, any blind spots you might have. And I think one great way of getting that is having very good supervision.
Excellent. We talked a little bit about, just last week, about transference and countertransference. Mm-hmm. So we're at least familiar with some of those concepts. Yes. You mentioned further training. So what sort of training have you sought since graduation? Or have you?
I mean,
continuing education.
Yeah, so I've done, so I've had, my program was primarily psychodynamic and family systems, but there is very much a need to be trained in CBT. So I've had a lot of, there's a form of CBT called dialectical behavioral therapy. And when I was working at Bellevue Hospital, I worked in a personality disorder program or interned where DBT was the primary source of treatment. And it pulls from, it's primarily CBT, but it pulls from family system, it pulls from psychodynamic. So I felt I could, it felt more justifiable through my lens that fit into my framework. So after graduating, I did some of Marsha Linehan's The Creator of DBT. I did several workshops to become more skilled in, mm-hmm. in that specific treatment approach.
And she's right here from Connecticut.
Is she? Oh. Oh, I didn't know that.
University of Hartford.
So she's the one person that has made a lot of money.
That's right. If you can invent your own
form of therapy, package it in a really nice book and workbook and republish every 3 years.
And part of that's driven, right, by what insurance companies pay for and the sorts of treatments that
Absolutely.
Are on the panels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think being, to me, even if I might be practicing DBT, I always use my understanding of families, for example, to understand, I do a lot of work with, parents, doing parent counseling, when they have a younger child who might not be appropriate for therapy. So maybe I use more strategies and skills from DBT with the kids and their parents, but my understanding of how their family works, the dynamics, the communication styles, the things that are said and not said, help me at least frame what's going on. I might not use it in the moment, but it does help me, I think, provide interventions more effectively.
Hmm. Now you're also doing teaching, at WestCon. Mm-hmm. Do you have the graduate program in the education
yes.
department.
Yep.
Maybe you could tell them a little bit about that. But my general question is, how does that play a role in your career? Does it tie into your other work?
Absolutely. I always find that there are, always being kind of with my foot in the clinical experience gives me a lot of good examples to use. You can read a textbook, you can read the DSM, the symptoms, but they're just words until I think you can attach meaning to them. So I try and always bring in real life examples to help clarify certain concepts. And I taught a lot of a variety. Before the internship, I was like a new class every semester. So I think I taught psychology of women, child psych,
That's
adolescent
my
psych. but in, going back to that kind of generalist training, I can pop it in where it feels relevant.
And you always get tremendous ratings, feedback from your students. So obviously you're able to bring whatever class you teach some of that real world experience that students value so highly. What advice would you give for young people that are mm-hmm. interested in the mental health field, looking back on your mm-hmm. own career so far?
I think before committing, I think you can do something with a bachelor's degree in psychology. There are certainly career options, but I do think that they're limited, and most people do have a desire or begin to understand that you need some further training, at least, if not a master's degree, to pursue their kind of ideal career. And so my advice has a lot to do with being really sure, or mostly sure, what you want to do before committing, even if that means taking some time to figure it out. There's never any, I don't think, disadvantage to working for a year or two, getting an understanding of what the field is actually like, and then committing to a more intensive graduate training. Because I think it helps you you could get through the training more quickly. Obviously, you have your set classes, but you don't need to stop. Maybe you don't like a program because you don't really want to pursue marriage and family counseling, so then you have to switch to something else. It can help you tailor your internship experiences. Most programs require you to do some field placement. So if you kind of have had experience knowing what you like and also what you don't like. I worked in a foster care agency for one of my trainings, and 1 year there was enough to know that working with kids and families that had problems of that nature was not something I felt was a good fit for me. So I've had it, and I know what to do when there's issues of that nature presented to me, but it's not something I could do on a day-to-day basis. So then knowing what more or less kind of the direction you want to head in is important, so you can get through it. And also, I mean, I always go back to the financial piece. It really sticks in my mind. So many of my peers in my master's and doctoral program entered into it taking loans out in every direction. Loans to go to school, loans to live, loans to pay their bills, and are now really struggling with the debt relative to what they're making as an entry level psychologist.
Right.
So I think, I know for myself, I had my master's, so I was fortunate to be able to work during my doctoral program, which isn't, always the case. Like, there are limitations to that as well, but I think it really helped prevent me from facing that dilemma once I was done.
So it's like we need a one-credit course in school on, like, financial decision-making as you go forward
right.
with graduate school.
I mean, because I get it. I remember being, like, 24, and I just needed to get into a doctoral program. So those programs that would have probably accepted me as long as I had my master's in counseling and I could pay the enormous bill, like, I looked, I dabbled. Like, it was appealing on some level because I wanted to do it. And I think that, in hindsight, I can recognize how I could have made a decision based on that, wanting to, like, just get it over with.
Right, which probably would have been a mistake for you.
Correct.
Right. All right, so at this point, the end of the interview, I open it up to the whole class. And so if you have questions,
okay.
So the hands are shooting up.
I feel like...
So, Shannon.
Okay, so we kind of talked about this, but, like, master's versus, like, getting your doctorate and stuff. So, like, you can't be called a doctor if you have your master's, obviously. But, like, you can, like... does not own your own practice, but you can counsel, like, people. Like, I'm confused. Do you kind of understand my question?
Kind of.
So let me. I'll repeat the question for the audio. What's the level of independence you can have as a master's graduate? You're not a licensed psychologist at the PhD level, but where can you stand with licensure and things like that?
So. If you choose a master's program that has a in Connecticut, it would be a master's program in counseling where graduating would end in being able to sit for the licensed professional counselor exam. So with that, you could function as an independent practitioner. That versus and I don't know any off the top of my head, but there are some terminal master's degrees in psychology. There can be a...
Like school psychology is a terminal master's. Is that what you're thinking of?
No, because school psychology, you can then sit for...
The school psychologist exam.
There are some just open-ended psychology master's programs. Mm-hmm. So I think if you are thinking of the terminal master's program mm-hmm. and you want to practice, mm-hmm. you should look for something that has... that allows you to be qualified to sit for the licensing exam. So
yeah,
a general master's in applied psychology or a master's
right.
in child development is not going to allow you to sit for any type of licensing exam.
Right. I think there's one, for example, at Sacred Heart University that's it's a master's
yes,
in
you're right.
applied
yep.
psychology.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really...
No.
You
I
can't
mean,
sit for any certificate or licensure
yes.
afterwards.
Right.
Rodrigo and then Barbara.
You said you talked about, you use a lot of DBT with people with borderline personality disorders.
So that's where I initially got my training.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that therapy versus mentalization, what would you say is like the key differences in the two, and which one would you say works better?
So the question is differences between DBT and mentalization.
So mentalization has more of a psychodynamic background and is less focused on skill building. So the core of DBT is that you help patients be able to acquire skills to regulate their emotions, to become aware of what they're, first become aware of what they're feeling, regulate. So it's more applied. Mentalization, and I don't have specific training in that type of therapy, but from what I'm remembering, mentalization is our ability to think about ourselves and others. So I mentalize, I think to myself, I wonder how my boss felt about what I said in our meeting. Right? I'm thinking about what I said and how the other person reacted. So it's thought that people with borderline personality disorder really lack that quality of being able to understand self and other. So it's more, I think, exploratory, more process-oriented, and less focused on skill building.
And less focused on skill building?
Yeah. Okay. There's not a, DBT has a specific skills group you're supposed to attend in addition to your individual therapy,
right,
where you learn these modules: mindfulness, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and interpersonal effectiveness. Mentalization has some strategies attached to it, but they're not nearly as structured.
Barbara. Okay, so there's two questions. One is about going on, even if you have got licensure as a master's level psychologist. And the other question is, what sort of training do you need for prescribing medication as a psychologist?
So I think going on for additional training after the LPC is a very personal choice based on what you find out once you're licensed and practicing, if there's a greater need, if you feel like you're limited, if you really want to be the director of a clinic, for example, and the requirements are always such that you need a doctoral degree to be able to do that, I think that, what options or limitations you have should certainly inform that decision. For some people who, are content with practicing individual therapy, maybe work in a clinic and have a little private practice on the side, I don't know that there's much reason to go beyond that unless you maybe have an interest in teaching or research or expanding your testing, for example, is somewhat exclusive to psychologists. So I think unless you want to expand your role, you have to really determine that, though, once you're finished. The second question.
Medication prescriptions.
Oh, PsyDs or PhDs can prescribe medication in most states. There's maybe two states where you can prescribe medication as a psychologist, regardless of the type of psychologist degree you have. But you need extra training and coursework. I don't know which states those are.
From my reading of it over the last couple of decades, there was for a while a real push to get psychologists to have prescription privileges. I think APA and others saw it as a means of broadening the practice of psychologists. It's been most effective in the military because of the need of them. They don't have enough psychiatrists and people who are licensed, particularly in more remote bases. And there is a well-established military training program, so if you're a military psychologist, you can get that. Outside of that, it's very hard to get that sort of training, and so it sort of has, I would say, it's receding at the moment. Instead of growing, it's, I think, less psychologists are interested in doing that. And partly, too, it's a matter of insurance. Once you get that, your insurance rates skyrocket, and they're already high enough.
Yeah.
But as as a prescription provider, it's worse. Other questions? Shannon and then Ada. So the question is, when you first started, were you nervous? And I'm sure no nervousness
whatsoever.
It's like
it came right in my fingertips. It's so easy. I was terrified. And I think that I was probably nervous for a good 3 years of my training, it reduced, but I don't know that I really gained even a true comfort of, you know, like now I will walk in, glance at the kind of like the medical chart, and am genuinely curious, wonder what's going to happen at this consultation. So that's the end point. But leading up to it, I would try and like maybe if there was any records or any information, really like try and be prepared. That helps. It was a coping mechanism as a way to like control my anxiety. I felt like if I was more prepared, I would know how to manage the situation. But I think it's a process. It's a process. There's no way to get over it quickly. I think it comes with practice and experience and feeling like more competence in yourself.
It's like exposure therapy.
Absolutely. Totally. And you will. That's one part of it.
Question from Ada.
No, if I know someone has seen our pediatric neurologist, I try my very best to review the chart to know like why he's referring them and to get a little background information working with children. If anyone is interested, parents place a high expectation that you know or are in the loop. There's that's maybe something I've learned more. I maybe didn't do that in the beginning, but I would get the parents to be like, you talked to Dr. Yorns, right? Right, as soon as I got in. So I learned that there was an expectation, and part of the field is the helping profession, but there's also a customer service aspect, you know, especially if you're thinking of a private practice. You want your patients to return, you know, with your bread and butter. So I think that I try and look ahead of time. That's not always the case because pretty stacked, you know, I see people in 45 minutes and 9 to 9:45, 9:45 to 10:30 until I leave. So I might miss something here or there. But I know that whatever I don't know, I can always ask. And as much as I'm making a joke about people being upset you don't know things, most people are understanding and are willing to share their story even if it's in that piece of information is in their chart. Yes, I think I would have gotten more specific training. I was talking about the psychoeducational testing, and I'm going to be honest here. So it's because it's profitable. Psychoeducational testing is not something that's covered by insurance. So people have, like insurance companies say, it, in all the fine print, testing for academic purposes, which is really sad, is not covered because schools technically should supply this type of testing, but public schools are usually... can be very understaffed and overburdened by the amount of kids who need testing. So from a perspective of ways to build kind of the financial aspect of my career, I think that I wish I had. I've been getting that training after I finished. So I worked for about a year right after my kids were born at a private practice that just did psychoeducational testing. So I got enough training there that I can do it independently now. But looking back, I wish I had noticed that that would be something that I could kind of do on my own and had got the training earlier on. Yeah,
thank you. Yes. Thank you. And I think we need to invite you back at some stage for like part two, which is like, how do you balance a personal life and a professional life, right? Working mother, young children. Husband to look after. So let's thank.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Sure.